Hello and welcome to the latest Fraser Valander podcast. My name is Adam McGeoch and I'm an economist here at the Institute. And today I'm joined by Professor Mary Spowage, our director. So this is part of our series where we are going to be discussing the latest data on the Scottish and UK economy and also discuss a bit about what's going on in policy. So Mary, starting with UK government policy, a lot has been going on over the past few weeks. How have markets responded to some of the UK government's policies and some of their changes to proposed policies that they had made earlier last month?
Yeah, it's felt like the last few weeks has been about 3 years long with all of the different policy announcements and the impact that it's had on the markets and the economy. I suppose we have to go back after Liz Truss was appointed PM and in the first week of her premiership, she announced a large package of interventions in the energy market in order to cap the average bill at around £2,500 through capping the unit price that everybody paid. And this was in the face of potentially huge rises in energy prices both in October, but also then subsequently in January and April that were being predicted by Ofgem at the time. So massive intervention, huge amount of money likely to be spent on this intervention, and little detail when the government first announced this of the cost that might be attached to that. Now, whilst not everyone was in favour of exactly the type of intervention and particularly the way it was untargeted, so it wasn't just targeted at those on lowest incomes, but it's going to help everybody. There wasn't really a huge reaction in the markets to that announcement. What really happened was when the mini budget on the 23rd of September, or the fiscal statement as the government actually called it, happened, there was a huge amount of, alongside this large energy package, there was a huge amount of unfunded tax cuts announced as well. So this was stuff that had been well trailed, like corporation tax not increasing as had been previously planned, and the national insurance rise that had been put in place from April being cut. But also the more surprise announcements of the bringing forward of the cut in the basic rate of income tax, and most surprisingly, the abolition of the additional rate for those who earn over £150,000. I think as well, because the government did all this without the scrutiny of the independent OBR, so essentially there were all these announcements, but there was no independent analysis of how much these things would cost and also what the impact might be on the government's deficit and debt. I think both the nature of the announcements and the fact they were unfunded and funded by borrowing, and the fact there wasn't this independent scrutiny, led to a lot of turmoil in the markets. And essentially what we saw was that the cost for the government to borrow, so the cost of government gilts, shot up. So basically the markets were saying, we think the UK is a bit more of a risky proposition. So if you want to borrow from us, UK government, you're going to have to pay a bit more for that. We need a bigger return to make it worth our while. So that's what happened on the evening and of Friday the 23rd. I think what didn't help was the fact that the Chancellor was on then Sunday morning interviews saying after this that this was just the start, there is more to come. And what we saw was a big run on the pound after that, which meant that the pound slumped to an all-time low against the dollar of $1.03. So all of this kind of turmoil in the markets, so the cost of government borrowing going up, the pound slumping against all currencies, but particularly against the dollar, led the government to U-turn on the scrapping of the additional rate. Although it's worth remembering that this was very much a small measure fiscally. In terms of the £45 billion of tax cuts announced, that's only £2 billion of it. So there's still a lot of tax cuts that the government are saying is on the table. What was also confirmed was that the the UK would be releasing more information over the course of the next couple of months, that they would be putting out a medium-term fiscal plan on the 23rd of November. Since that first announcement was made, there's been a bit of back and forth on when exactly this plan will happen and when it will take place. But now it seems that they've gone for the 31st of October to present that plan, and that will include OBR forecasts as well. So it'll be really interesting to see whether the OBR disagree with any of the costings that the government have put out, and what their assessment is of these, the impact these policy measures could have on the economy. You know, do the OBR think that they will stimulate growth, as the UK government are keen to hope? And also, what's the overall impact on the pathway for government deficit and debt over the next 5 years as a result of the current government's plans?
And all eyes really will be on the UK government when they publish their medium-term fiscal plan. What does this plan mean for Scotland?
Yeah, well, there's the plan that's going to be published on the 31st, and then there's the Bank of England's rate decision, which comes later that week on the 3rd of November. So, I mean, it will be interesting to see what the Bank of England make of the plan. And then obviously the Bank of England will then take a decision on interest rates. And whilst it was always expected they would raise them again, the turmoil that's happened over the last few weeks probably means that they'll raise them more than they would have otherwise done. So that obviously has an impact on mortgage payers. So all of these things will have an impact on mortgage payers right across the UK. There's obviously tax cutting initiatives which will also impact on taxpayers in Scotland. So the national insurance cut, which comes into force on the 6th of November, will impact everybody, give people a little bit more money in their pockets. The income tax changes, however, will not, because income tax is devolved. So really, we don't know yet what impact, what sort of response there'll be from the Scottish government to this tax cut from the UK government, whether they'll follow suit in some way or not. There's a very different income tax schedule already in place in Scotland. There's a 5-band income tax structure. So there's not an exact, corollary between the sorts of policy choices that could be made. But certainly there's a choice here for the Scottish government to think about whether they in some way match this tax cutting policy or not. We've got to remember that there's a very tight fiscal settlement in Scotland, i.e. the budget's under a lot of pressure due to all of these public sector pay disputes that are having to be settled with higher wage rises than were envisaged when the budget was set. So there's not a lot of money sitting about. Potentially, I suppose the government could be tempted to say, well, we're not going to follow suit and we're going to use some of the additional resources that we'll get as a result of this in order to fund services. And just as an aside for our listeners, the reason that the Scottish government gets more money or more resources as a result of tax cuts in England is because of the way the fiscal framework operates. Essentially, to reflect the fact that income tax is now devolved, the UK government makes a deduction from the Scottish block grant, and then income tax receipts are then added back on. So that's the basis of that deduction is receipts, tax receipts per head in England. So if they're cut because the rate is cut, the deduction is smaller, and therefore there's a net benefit to the overall resources available to the Scottish government. So none of that's kind of simple and straightforward, but that's the reason that we end up with funding to be able to think, do we want to do a similar tax cut? Or do we want to keep that money to spend on services?
So there's quite a lot of uncertainty in terms of, you know, what's coming around the corner for both the UK and Scottish economy. And in times of uncertainty, it's difficult to make forecasts of the outlook for economic growth. But last week we published our quarterly economic commentary for Q3, where we published some forecasts of the Scottish economy. Mary, could you tell us a bit about what these forecasts told us?
Yeah, so I mean, I feel like I say this every quarter we release our forecasts, but economic forecasting is a difficult business at the best of times. And over the last few years, it's been almost impossible to think what's going to happen next. We are in quite a state of turmoil in the economy right now. And the last few weeks shows how much the economy can be influenced by decisions that the government make. It's a difficult business, but we have updated our forecasts from June. We've made them quite considerably worse, it has to be said. And our expectation is that quarter three of 2022 is likely to have been a contraction slightly. And we'll see a bigger contraction in quarter four as the rising costs of energy and inflation continues to bite and continues to eat into the spending power of consumers. Our expectation is that contraction in the economy is likely to last into the second or third quarter of 2023 before returning to growth in the second half of the year. So overall, we think 2023 will be a contraction in the economy compared to the 2022 average before returning to pretty poor growth, but growth nonetheless in 2024. But we'll update our forecast again in December and we'll see, you know, kind of what the pathway of the economy is and what quarter C ended up being in terms of the measured growth. But forecasts in general, you'll see forecasters start to worsen their forecasts for 2023 and 2024 as they update them over the next couple of months.
So just moving on slightly to some stats that we got this morning from the ONS on the labour market, which saw unemployment in Scotland covering the three-month period to the end of August fall to 3.3%, down 0.3 percentage points on the previous quarter. Employment was also up and economic inactivity was down. So Scotland's labour market performance over the year has improved, and relative to the UK, we are performing slightly better. And not only just this, but Scotland is now back to pre-pandemic levels of hours worked in the economy. So, Mary, unemployment across the UK is now at its lowest level since 1974. Can you explain how, in a time of crisis that we're in, that we're seeing such low levels of unemployment and quite good labour market indicators?
Yeah, I mean, these headline indicators do paint a relatively healthy picture of conditions in the labour market. Although if you dig underneath them, there are some, you know, some quite worrying patterns in the data. Obviously, we're in a situation where labour supply is quite limited. So there are lots of vacancies in the economy. And therefore, you know, generally, if people are wanting to find a job, there are jobs available. And really, the problem for employers is finding the right people with the right skills in the right place to be able to perform different roles. If we look over the piece, like compared to pre-pandemic, there is a worrying trend evident in the latest data, which is the increase in economic activity compared to a few years ago. So there does seem to be a big increase in the surge of economic inactivity due to sickness, particularly amongst men. Another interesting thing on the data that's been released is the sort of unequal pace of economic recovery across Scotland. So if we look at particularly the northeast, and if you're thinking about oil and gas transition, obviously this is really important. You see that Aberdeen City and Aberdeenshire have fewer workers on the payroll than before the pandemic. And if you contrast that with other parts of Scotland, payroll employment in Glasgow is up over 4% over the same period. So it's clear, we're getting sort of clearer indicators of the impact of the pandemic over these headline labour market indicators. And whilst we're not seeing a surge in unemployment, the increase in inactivity is particularly worrying for the long-term health of our economy.
Today's stats also showed across GB in the period of June to August that growth in average total pay, so this includes bonuses, was up 6% and was up 5.4% when we exclude bonuses. Private sector pay was up by 6.2%, whilst public sector pay stood at just a 2.2% rise. But in real terms, overall, total pay did fall by 2.4% for total pay, including bonuses, and decreased by 2.9% for regular pay. So we're seeing inflation really eat into wage growth. So, Mary, how is the slow real wage growth that we're seeing in the economy, how is that impacting households?
Well, it just means that basically households have effectively less money to spend because the money that they do have will go less far. And if your wages are going up by 5%, but food inflation is running at 12%, which is what it currently is, then you can see that you're going to have less money to spend, and you'll be able to buy less with the same amount of money than you were before. And what it probably means for consumers is that they're going to cut back on anything that's discretionary, and they're going to focus their money, if they have enough for that, on non-discretionary items like food and energy. And we know that energy has jumped up again in October. Food price inflation continues to run well above the headline inflation rate. So we're likely to see continued pressures on household budgets. And what does that mean? People trim, they cut back, they trim what they're spending on other areas, and that will lead to issues in certain parts of the economy. And one of the reasons why we're likely to see a contraction in economic growth over the next few quarters. I think as well, we can talk about, households and the average household. But what we've got to think about is the distribution. When we released our economic commentary last week, we did some really interesting analysis about the impact of inflation on households of different income levels. And what that showed was that the inflation rate for the poorest household is much higher than the average. And the inflation rate for the wealthiest households is lower than the average. So you're seeing bigger impacts of price rises on these lower income households, mainly due to the things I've talked about of food inflation and people in those households spending more on those sorts of essentials. And then if you go under the wage data, what you also see is that the wage rises for those in the poorest households are lower than the average. So these households are not being able to attract as much of a wage rise as households in the sort of the median part of the income distribution or the high part of the income distribution. So these households are seeing the biggest increase in prices and the lowest increase in wages. And what that means is that they're likely to have to be significant help from policymakers and government for these sorts of households so that they don't face real problems and real destitution over the winter.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you everyone for joining today for our latest Fraser Ballander podcast. You can find out more about the stuff that we regularly publish on our website, fraserballander.org, and please stay tuned for further podcast series on the Scottish and UK economy.